Hey, what's that? Central question. Thank you, everybody, for coming. Everybody has one, I assume?
Yeah.
Okay. So.
I'll show you. Simple.
Okay. So, what I thought. Now we start. Okay, we're good. So, what I thought to do today. For this series, Bezrat Hashem, this week, and then we're taking a couple weeks off, and then two more. But I wanted to do this year. We touched on it last year, for those who remember, in the two shiurim that we had on Esther. What I would like to do is, rather than take Megillat Esther and the overarching themes of the Megillah as a whole, what I want to do is focus on three individual characters. I want and see how that character develops and how it presents itself and what shifts. Major and minor happen throughout the text. The first of those of the three that I chose to do is Haman. I think he's particularly interesting because the reason why I chose Haman, I didn't put any of the Chazals here, but we went through them last year. I think to a large degree we're all familiar with them. When we think about the surrounding aspects of the other than the Mitzvot Hayom, other than Kiyat Megillah and Matanas Savionim and Shalach Manos. You think about the Kriyat Torah of the day of Purim. You think about the Shabbos Zohar that precedes Purim. What character of Megillat Esther and the story of Purim do we often associate with? What biblical figure? What biblical people? What biblical theme? Amalek. All right. And that's not random. If you look in Chazal, we discussed this last year at length. So much of the discussion that goes on with Megillat Esther about whether it's going to enter the canon of Tanakh, whether it's going to be part of scriptures, whether it's going to be on the same level as everything else, it hinges on, it depends on the viewing of Megillat Esther, the story of Purim, as this grand clash of Bnei Israel and their detractors, or more specifically, the Jewish people and the evil peoples of Amalek. Purim's definition, caught up in Purim's definition, certainly in Chazal's view, is that Purim is representative of Amalek. Haman, by extension, is representative of Amalek. And we'll see in a few moments when we look at his character development, specifically in the Megillah. The Megillah actually does reference this itself. So they're not coming out of nowhere, but one of the things that I want to touch on today is to what extent this is the theme of the Jewish people, right? Bnei Israel versus their enemies. And to what extent we actually are going to tie this to the biblical character of Amalek, the people of Amalek, the people that are relevant to the mitzvah of Zechirat and Mechiyat Amalek that we're going to commemorate on Shabbat Zohar. Again, the point one of the points that I'd like to just keep in the back of our minds as we're going through this is to what extent we're talking about the concept of evil and the enemies of Bnei Israel, and to what extent we're talking about the actual Zerah of Amalek. And if there's a particular difference of the two. Okay, so do we have any Shakespeare fans amongst us? Anybody? Myra?
Yeah.
Are you a Shakespearean? Okay, so tell us about does the Macbeth quote ring a bell at the top of the sheet?
I think it may. I mean, I'm more familiar with the soliloquy at the end than this.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I particularly chose this quote because I thought it was extremely relevant. Macbeth is basically weighing whether or not to go forward with his assassination chanofs here, and most of the Shakespeare leading off shiurim that I ever heard were from Lichtenstein. So in honor of our esteemed Talmud of Yeshiva Har Etzion, I chose to do this. So so the Macbeth is trying to weigh whether or not to go through with his plot to assassinate King Duncan. And he basically acknowledges here, I have no spur to... He's trying to find the justification. He's trying to figure out whether or not he wants to do it. And he says, I have no spur to prick the sides of my intent. Sir, think it's a metaphor. Think of the imagery of a spur on a boot, that you use to spur an animal that you're riding. Right? So he's using it as... It's an impetus. The spur is the impetus. He can think of no impetus with which to guide his plan to assassinate King Duncan... But only, what is the only motivation that he has? But only vaulting ambition. The only reason why he wants to go through with this, what many would consider this evil act of assassination of a king, is because of his own career, is because of his own path He wants to vault himself, and because of that, that's the only thing that that's guiding him. He can't think of any other reason to go through with it. But not only that, he doesn't just, Shakespeare doesn't, you know, put the words in Macbeth's mouth. He doesn't just end with the vaulting ambition. He describes the vaulting ambition, which overleaps itself and falls on the other. That's what Shakespeare means, I think, in this term, is that the ambition that he's talking about isn't just the regular ambition that every Joe Schmo has, that we all do about, I want to be a good John Q. taxpayer, pay our bills, and support our family. This is the type of ambition that's it's overwhelming, right? It folds over itself over and over and over again. It's the only thing single-mindedly focused on his ambition. He can't focus on anything else. The sole focus and goal of Macbeth's life is to rise in stature and rise in power. And that's what's guiding him. He's obsessed with this ambition. And I thought that was a particularly appropriate quote to kick off what I think is going to be what I think is the overarching theme of our discussion of the character of Haman. So, the sources that I have, almost all of them are just excerpts from Esther. I skipped everything that has nothing to do with Haman. And we'll get to those passages, Bezrat Hashem, in the coming Shirim. But what I want to focus on right now is just Haman, how he's introduced, how he comes along, how his character changes throughout the process. So let's start with source number one. We're in Perek Yimel, right? This is the third chapter. We're, just to remind ourselves in our recap, chapter one introduces Ahasuerus, comes introduces this his beautiful queen who he decides to kill. The plot, I think probably one of the other than the centered narrative of Ahasuerus and Vashti and killing her, the most important thing is that it introduces us to the character of Ahasuerus and what he's willing to do, his tendencies, what his anxieties are, what he's willing to do, what he's not willing to do, who he seeks advice from, his general way about it, the way the court works, Ahasuerus' court worked. That was chapter one. Chapter two is the introduction of Esther and Mordechai and the introduction of Esther and Mordechai and the plan to replace Vashti with Queen Esther. Okay, which we see, we start to develop those characters, and Bezrat Hashem in the coming weeks we'll look at those chapters more closely. Chapter 3, Perek Gimel, is when we are now introduced to Haman. Acharet v'rimo ila. Gidal ha-melech ha-chashverosh et Haman ben Hamadatah ha-gagi. Okay, so we have this guy coming along. Now, the Chazal point to this character, Muchan, from the beginning, from the first chapter. The one who comes up with the idea of getting rid of Vashti, replacing her with somebody, the Rasa Tovami Mena, somebody who's even better than her, and having this whole plan of having the concubines come in, prepare for the year, and then Ahasuerus choosing from them. That was Memucha. Now, the reason why, it's understandable why, because why Chazal are they're coming from in that, because the person in Ahasuerus's ear, in chapter 1, in Perek Aleph, is this guy Memucha. The guy in Ahasuerus's ear, and the rest of the Megillah, seems to be Haman. That's mostly where they're coming from. There's reason to make that argument, but I think the mitigating argument, the reason to say that that's not the case, is because Memuchan, do you notice in what Memuchan does? And we didn't look at the text inside, but just from our knowledge of the story, do you notice Memuchan doing anything on behalf of himself? Who is he working for? Who's Memuchan when he proposes this plan? It's all, we need to preserve the honor of the monarchy, we need to preserve the honor of the king. It can't be that this word is ever going to get out that what this lousy Queen Vashti did. What's his driving factor? Is it vaulting ambition that's guiding Memuchan? What is it? What do you think?
Loyalty.
Yeah, I would say definitely it's loyalty. It's and as we're going to see with Haman in a second, that's a very important point, because what the key to success in Ahasuerus' kingdom is loyalty. That might have a lot to do with Ahasuerus' character, which maybe we'll get to when we're profiling him. But the key is loyalty. Memuchan is extremely loyal. The only thing he's concerned with is he doesn't even mention himself. He doesn't, no idea of me. I came up with such a great idea. Why don't you dress me in the king's clothes? He just says, I have this idea. We're going to preserve the honor of the monarchy. We're going to preserve the honor of the queen. And we're not maybe most importantly, we're going to preserve the proper roles of a husband and a wife through all of the houses of the kingdom. That was his guiding focus. Here, we have this guy Haman, who we're meeting him now, but as we're going to see, that seems to be, maybe not the case, and maybe vaulting ambition is where he's coming from. Okay, so what do we know about him from the start? Does the text tell us why he promoted him? No, it does not. Now, it could be that there are any number of reasons why it could be, but the simple answer as to why he's being promoted, or why the text doesn't tell us that he was promoted, is that it doesn't matter. Right? The text isn't concerned with why he was promoted. All we need to know is that this guy is now somebody that was raised up by the king. And maybe, since the only thing that we know in the introduction is that Haman is being raised by the king, maybe we're meant to think that that's the only thing that he really cares about. Right? It didn't cite some great act. And the reason why I mention this, think of the other comparisons that we can make in Esther. Think of who do we know in Esther, in the Megillah, that has done things for the king? So we know of Muhan, we just talked about that one. Seems to be pure devotion. Who else? I'm sorry? Yeah, so Bigan and Teresh, they were plotting against them, but who?
Mordechai.
So, and how does the king react to that? That was a pure act of, if Mordechai didn't care about the monarch, or he didn't care about Ahasuerus, or, all right, he would have let things go, but he knew something, and he acted on their behalf. So that's a case where Ahasuerus was Gidal somebody else, but we know exactly why he was doing it. Here, it doesn't matter. So again, Haman might have given him great advice or great guidance on some other issue. The fact that the Megillah only tells us that Ahasuerus raised him up, I'm suggesting here, maybe not, maybe yes, maybe no, might be that off the bat we're meant to think that the most important thing that Haman cares about is his own vaulting ambition. To what extent he can rise higher in the upper echelons of the Persian monarchy. Okay, so that's the first thing that we know about him. That Ahasuerus raised him up. We don't know why. Who was this guy? Haman ben Hamadatta. We know the way Tanakh usually introduces somebody. Haman ben Hamadatta. And who was this guy? Ha'agagi. Alright? So, the question is what Agagi means. It really could mean any number of things. Now, I didn't put too many mufarshim here, but flip back to page 2. It could be, and probably is, the simple pshat of the pasuk is that we're trying to highlight who Amalek is. Let me use the words of the Dat Mikra by Amos Chacham. It is a magnificent, magnificent perush on Esther. If anybody hasn't seen it, so this is part of the Dat Mikra series. Amos Chacham, who is the scholar that did Esther, and it's as far as commentaries go, it's really really easy to read. I think that they started translating it into English years ago. I don't know if they did Esther. But as far as commentaries go, the Hebrew of Chacham is really easy, and it's actually all it's got dots in it, so it's easy to for those of us who prefer that. Okay, so he cites three approaches actually in Farshim, ancient and latter day. So source number 2, Ha'agagi, Hakadmonim Pirshu Mizera Agag Melech Amalek. Well, the simple understanding, which probably is the case, because there's no term Agagi in all of Tanakh. There's one character named Agag. And does anybody know, for 10 bonus points, what the other reference to Agag is in all of Tanakh? Well, that's who I'm referring. That's what I mean. There's the character of Agag in Shmuel Aleph. And does anybody know? Bal Kore, Parshas Balak. Anybody? Simcha. It's Bilam's. It's part of Bilam's bracha. Part of Bilam's bracha to Bnei Yisrael is that they're going to overcome overcome Agag. Now, in the context of that, and this is actually why this is important. It could be that that's a reference. How do you read Agag? So the classical Mufarshim will read it as a prophecy of Shaul overcoming the Melech Agag of Amalek. What it also possibly could be is a reference to some other tribe. Now, if it's the second of the things I just suggested, then when Megillat Esther refers to Haman HaAgagi, even though there's lots of peoples out of the earth that the Tanakh doesn't really ever mention, it could be that that one mention is enough for us to think, oh, there's a people named, there's some sort of people named Agag out there, and it's not a reference to Agag Melech Amalek. But, okay, let me just finish. So, Pirshu Mizera Agag Melech Amalek, that's in number 1, so, line 2 in source number 2. Umin ha'achornim yesh shemisha'arim she'agag ze'eno Agag Melech Amalek ela shem mishpacha parsit. All it is Agag is just some Persian name. The same way that the Megillah, and this is probably the least enchanting explanation of who Agag is, right? It's not supposed to get our imagination to go. The idea is the same way that Hamadatta is not a person of any consequence in the Megillah, but the Megillah is willing to is willing to tell us who that Haman was, the child of Hamadatta. The same, that same way, Hamadatta's father or Hamadatta's grandfather or some family name, all right, the Rothschilds. This is the Rothschilds, or the or the Bourbons of France. The Agagim of Persia were a family name. So it could be that. So if we're going to say that sort of like number two, and if we didn't have Hamadatta, I would say that there's no way that this could be. But the fact that we do have Hamadatta, we have a name in the Megillah relating to Haman that has absolutely nothing to do with anything, I think that actually is a plausible explanation. The Yesh Misha'arim, all right, third answer, we're in the third line, last line, of Yesh Misha'arim, Sha'yudim, Kanuhu Agagi al Shem Risho. What was this Haman Agagi? All right, this was a nickname that the Jews gave him. Why? Because he was such an evil person. All right, how many drashot have been said over the years about how Hitler is the character of Amalek, Nazism is the character of Amalek? The same way that we have that, the Jews of Shushan had a nickname for anybody that was against the Jewish people. That was Agagi. All right. So it was like calling somebody Hitler-esque, right? In the character of their hatred towards the Jewish people. Okay, so three pshatim that the Amos Chacham gives brings down as to what this term Agagi actually means. All of them are possible. If it's the first or the third, then this, in addition to something about Haman's character, Megillah is trying to tell us, it's trying to give us this indication of who Haman is actually, you know, who his character, not just his personal character is, but what his ideology is. He stands for something the same way that Amalek stands for something. Right? Asher karcha baderech, when the Jewish people are starting to rise up, when they're starting to actually see success, this is somebody that's trying to undermine them. Now, depending on when we date the story of Purim, which we actually discussed last year in a couple of different contexts, it's likely that this Purim story actually happened after the Aliyah of Ezra and Nehemiah. They've already gone back, and now Mordechai is this court Jew that lives in Shushan as representative of this huge population of Jews that didn't go back. We all know that the Aliyah of Ezra and Nehemiah was paltry. There was tens of thousands of people, where the majority of Bnei Israel of Bnei Yehuda actually remained in Galut and didn't go with Ezra and Nehemiah. So if that's the case, we have, right, think of that character of Amalek. This is next week's parsha. V'shalach, we are leaving, we finally have had this triumphant exit of Mitzrayim after 210 years of slavery, backbreaking work, and then this miraculous salvation on the part of the Ribbono Shel Olam. And it's capped off with the greatest miracle anyone's ever seen, a sea actually splitting. And in the same moment, V'aminu v'Hashem v'Moshe Avdo, because not only have we escaped, but our Egyptian taskmasters have actually drowned in the process. In one fell swoop, with one stroke of the pen, HaKadosh Baruch Hu wipes us out and frees us and restores our faith. It was a brilliant, brilliant move. That's the moment when we are on the rise for the first time in centuries. We were on the rise. That's when Amalek came. Asher karcha baderech. Trying, not just being against the Jewish people, but trying to undermine them at the very moment of their ascension. If you think about it that way, all right, Haman coming along and trying to undermine the Jewish people as they are ascending once again after the Galut of Babel, because Ezra and Nehemiah are back. So again, try from that perspective, maybe that's what's coming. Where we're coming from when we're trying to allude to this idea of him being Amalek. Again, whether and if that's the case, whether he's actual Zera of Amalek or whether he is just the concept of Amalek, the way the third shot in Amos Chacham has. I'm not going to read it inside, but if you'll just the only other source other than Sukkim that I have here, the source number three, the Targumim. Of Nach are very interesting. So we're all familiar with the Targumim of the Torah of Uncleus and Yonatan ben Uzziel. The Targumim of the rest of Nach are there. They're Aramaic translations of the Torah of the Nevi'im and Ksuvim. But what they more often than Uncleus and even Yonatan ben Uzziel, they are commentaries as well. So there are actually two Targumim that are published, that are printed on Megillat Esther, and the Targum Sheni on Esther actually lists a lineage. You can take a look at it on your own. But it's source number three. It actually lists a lineage of Haman going all the way back to Esav, to Amalek, and then to Esav. So, particularly interesting that we're dealing with a with these ideas. Again, whether it's his personal connection, actual familial connection, or whether it's the idea, the concept of Amalek, either way, I think the Megillah, off the bat, when introducing Haman, is trying to give us some indication of who we're dealing with. If that's the case, then Chazal's emphasis of Amalek, the idea that we're surrounding Purim with the mitzvah of Zechirat and Mechiyat Amalek, all of that makes total sense. Everybody with me? Any questions? All right, I would say that that's probably our my first indication. This is before we know anything about Haman himself. This is just where he's coming from.
Is Esau also from Zerah Amalek?
No, Amalek is from Zerah Esau.
Amalek from Zerah Esau.
Okay, so the Targum is just explaining to us so that we know who we are. We know who we're dealing with. Again, whether it's this or whether it's the third shot in Amos Chacham, I think it's the same idea. We're meant to be off the bat by this reference of Agagi, shown who we're dealing with. Okay, I promise you the rest of the psukim that we're dealing with aren't going to take us this long. Okay, so we have this guy who's the Agagi. Vayinaseyu, Kadosh Baruch Hu, Achashverosh lifts him up. Vayasein et kiseo mial kol asarim asherito. So he was first among the servants. Okay, he was first among the servants. We know Achashverosh already from Perek Aleph. And Perek Bet, he relies heavily, as any monarch, as any leader does, relies heavily on his servants. And Haman was the first among the servants. Okay, now, this is where it gets interesting. Pasuk Bet. V'chol avdei ha-melech asher b'shar ha-melech. Everybody who was in the Shar ha-melech, everybody was there. All right, avdei ha-melech asher b'shar ha-melech. Okay, now let's focus on this. The avdei ha-melech asher b'shar ha-melech. Does that mean that everybody that comes along and sees Haman, we're referring to? Who are we referring to? Avdei ha-melech b'shar ha-melech. The king's servants that are within his court. This was what we're about to describe. What were they? What did they have to do? Korimu mishdach chavim lahaman. They would have to bow down to Haman. Why? Because, I'm sorry, when did they have to do it? Only within the court. Okay, now think of, have some image of a medieval, a medieval royal court. There's plenty of TV shows that, that have this idea. Anybody ever watch the, There's a HBO miniseries about John Adams. So they, whatever. They depict it, so part of it is they depict the court of St. James with King George after the American Revolution when Adams is there. To us it seems silly that there's so much focus on this one person and how everybody's focused around them. But that's the way, for a good part of human history, this is how it was the equivalent of Washington. But instead of, a good part of the day was spent with the equivalent of what would be for us, the President of the United States, sitting on his throne, and people just coming by and schmoozing and hanging, and if you were only there if you were a ranking member of society, I guess to some extent, I guess it's kind of like how Washington works today. But a big part of it though is just being a person of stature and being there. So there were people that were in the exclusive circle of the court, and only those people, the Avdei HaMelech B'Shar HaMelech, needed to bow. The fact that, we'll see Mordechai in a second. Kichein tziva lo HaMelech. Okay, now what's very important about here is that what was driving the requirement for everybody to bow down to Haman? Kichein tziva lo HaMelech. What was driving the requirement?
King.
It was the king's decree. Okay. Exactly. Okay. Is this about Haman's honor? Haman himself. This is about his honor. The requirements to kriya vishtach havaya, when Haman comes along. Is this because Haman is somebody that the king... Is this because Haman is deserving of honor?
No.
Why? What was the reason to do it?
Because the king said so.
If we're talking about anybody's honor right now, in fulfilling this decree, whose honor should we be talking about?
The king.
Okay. That's essential. All right? I want you to keep in mind this vaulting ambition image of Macbeth. So everybody needed to do it. U'Mordechai, our guy that we just met, who was the who brought up his cousin Esther, all right, and instructed her throughout this whole process. This guy Mordechai lo yichrev lo yishtachaveh. Okay, now first of all, this is a complete side point, but it's relevant to Haman. Who is go back to the middle of the pasuk? Who is commanded to bow down to Haman? Not everybody. Who? Avdei HaMelech, Avdei HaMelech, Asher B'Shar HaMelech. What does that tell us about Mordechai? Who was it? If Mordechai is defying a royal decree, the royal decree that we just described is only for the Avdei HaMelech B'Shar HaMelech. And if Haman is defying it, I'm sorry, thank you. If Mordechai is defying it, that means that Mordechai fits this picture. If we have the image of Mordechai as a guy with the longer beard sitting in the Beis Medrash outside of the king, you know, in the shtiebel that was down the block from the king's palace, we are mistaken. That's not who he was. He was a court Jew. He was somebody. Yeah.
Why would he be defying the king?
Good question.
Esther is.
Excellent question. And another one of the confounding things of Megillat Esther, which I think is it has to be essential to understanding the character of Mordechai. I think we'll get to it, but the Megillah does not tell us, the text does not tell us why Mordechai did not bow. Now, the Mefarshim like to talk about how what, you know, and this is how we're taught it as children. What drove Mordechai? Why did he refuse to bow?
Only to Hashem.
We only bow to God. Okay, and the problem is, Chana, help me out here. Why is that incorrect?
Because we bow.
Well, you, it's true that we're not supposed to bow down to other people, but if we look throughout Tanakh, do we have other examples of people bowing to people other than God?
Sure.
Kings? Not just kings, but yeah? Yaakov?
Avram was bowing to...
The Bnei Chet, right? Avram comes along and Parshat Chayesara and is bowing to Bnei Chet. We have tons of examples throughout Tanakh. I was looking back at the shiurim from last year. I listened back to the ones that we did last year and I realized how long they were. So I made a concerted effort to kind of skim down the makoros so that we don't take too long. So I didn't put them here, but in draft one of this, I had three or four examples in Tanakh of important Jews, even post-Matan Torah, bowing. So it's not entirely true. Now, if you want to talk about Shmad, if you want to talk about the principle rather than the halacha, okay, then we can talk about it. But it doesn't seem to be that's the driving motivation. And let me tell you, even if it was the driving motivation, the text doesn't seem to find it important enough to tell us. Now, it could be for other reasons. It could be that the text is deliberately leaving out religious aspects of the Megillah. It could be that. It could be for any number of reasons. But what we do know is that Mordechai was a member of Ahasuerus' court, and he refused to bow down to Haman. And this is couched in the fact that it is Asher Tziva HaMelech, a royal decree to bow down to Haman. Now, you're Haman. Okay? You are Haman, and you've just been raised to prominence, and you know that Ahasuerus, the one thing that he awards above all else is what? Loyalty. All right? If you are going to make a hullabaloo over this schnook, Mordechai, not bowing down to you, what's it going to be about? What should it be about? When you are petitioning to the king, this lousy Mordechai is doing what? He's defying you. It's nothing to do with me. Anochi afar ve'efer. Right? If you were Haman and you know who Ahasuerus is, then that's how you would couch it. That's how you would present it to the king. But we're going to see in a second. He kind of does that at the start, and then that's what kind of spells his success, and then immediately it stops. Okay, because the problem is Haman is not really somebody who cares about the king. He's not really a true servant, all right? Anybody Lord of the Rings fans? He's not Samwise, all right? He's not the guy who, under all circumstances, is going to follow Frodo. No? Lord of the Rings?
Yeah.
All right, never mind. Okay. Well, back when I was a kid and we were trying to really darshan the depth of Lord of the Rings, so we used to talk about the character of Sam, how Sam was, he was the Evid that was pure devotion to his master. Because it didn't matter, even at a point where he was willing to abandon the main mission because he was there to serve. It didn't matter. Okay, so. Okay, so, all right. So the point is that he's not purely devoted to Ahasuerus. He has the term that we'll continue to use is this vaulting ambition of Macbeth. Okay, we'll see that in a second. Vayomru Abdeh, all right, and how do we know about this? All right, how insignificant was this? Of Haman not bowing, Mordechai not bowing, Haman didn't even notice it. Who does he find out from? Pasuk Gimel. Vayomru Abdeh HaMelech Asher B'Sha'ar HaMelech. Who is talking now? It's not Haman. It's the other court people. It's the other members of the court. And they say to Mordechai, Madua ata overet mitzvat HaMelech. I have the green coat, the green color that I have here, is to highlight devotion to the king. Okay? So that's just so everybody knows. But so who is it that's talking? It's doing the talking? It's the Abdei HaMelech. It's the other members of the court, the other people who have the obligation to bow down. And they want to know why this guy Mordechai is not bowing down. Now, the simple understanding from this, the simple implication seems to be that nobody else seems to notice. Ahasuerus doesn't notice. Haman doesn't notice. All right? And depending on how extravagant of a bow it was, maybe that's why. If it was just one of these, then, all right, fine. So he was every time Haman came by, he was tying his shoe, or he was scratching his head, so nobody noticed. Maybe it's that there were so many members of the court that this one guy not doing it didn't bother him. Or wasn't anything to actually notice. But it's the other members, it's the other people that are asking him. And again, I emphasize this, I put it in green. Why is it that the other members of the court are angry at Mordechai, are questioning Mordechai? Is it because they think, Haman, he's a tzaddik yisod olam. Haman is the great, honorable and venerated Haman. How do you not honor him? That's not what they say. What do they say? Madua ata overet mitzvat hamelech. Why are you transgressing the king's decree? Okay? Now, this is a really important point, because I think it's what's also not just about telling us about Ahasuerush, but it's an important contrast to who Haman is, as we'll see. This is the opposite of vaulting ambition. This is the paradigm of somebody devoted, and that's who the Abdei HaMelech are. Okay, Vayihi Ki Amram Elav. They didn't just tell him this once. Vayihi Ki Amram Elav Yom Vayom V'lo Shema Aleihem. All right, who is doing this talking again? This is not a one day thing. This wasn't a random Tuesday. They noticed this day after day after day. The members of the court noticed that Haman did not give the due requisite honor to Mordechai. Did not give the due requisite honor to Haman. By the way, as a complete aside, what does it seem to imply? Who did Mordechai give the requisite honor to? You'd have to imagine that if Haman is getting bowed to, then Ahasuerus would also. So either Ahasuerus is completely absent from the court, or he had no problem honoring Ahasuerus. He only had a problem honoring Haman. We'll have to see why, or see if we can come up with a reason why. But this is something that did not happen once. It happened day after day after day. Ki Amram Elav Yom Vayom V'lo Shema Aleihem. And he never listened to them. V'yagidu LaHaman. All right. Finally, because this happened, this didn't happen once. This happened time after time after time. Yom by yom. It doesn't give us a time frame, but it gives you the impression that this was a significant period of time that this was happening over. They told Haman. Why did they tell Haman? Because they wanted to see if Mordechai's resolve would continue. They wanted to see if Mordechai would stay his ground. It seems almost as if it's a curiosity. All right. Lirot hayamdu divrei Mordechai. What did they think Haman was going to do? I don't know. But here is where I have the last line. Ki yigid lahem asher hu Yehudi. Okay, so the Abdei HaMelech, who are all interested in service of the king, seem to be mostly concerned with the king's honor never being infringed upon. Now we have them come along. And what do they say? This guy Mordechai is not bowing down to you. And by the way, he's a Jew. What relevance do you think that should have? It seemed to be that they knew that either that they were equally upset about the fact that Mordechai was a Jew, or they knew that this was the way to get Haman to test Mordechai's resolve.
Who's the Higid Lahem?
Higid Lahem Asher Hu Yehudi.
So is that saying that Mordechai told the Abdei HaMelech that Mordechai himself is a Jew, or the Abdei HaMelech told...
It's one person telling multiple people. So somebody... It's either that Haman knew Mordechai and knew that he was a Jew. It's a unspecific pronoun. This happens all the time in Tanakh. And the usual way to interpret it is to go back on the previous person mentioned. And this
question, do people know that Mordechai was a relative of Queen?
No, that specifically tells us in the previous chapter.
I mean,
we didn't see
it. She didn't reveal that she was Jewish, but they knew. Nobody knew.
She didn't know that she was Jewish, and she didn't know that she was a relative of Mordechai. Okay, now Mordechai, ki yigid lahem, the simple shot, because the previous person mentioned is Mordechai, ki yigid lahem, that Mordechai had told him that he was a Jew, not that it was
up there.
So Chazal described this about Mordechai, that he was a member of the Sanhedrin. If he was, it was later, because he's still a member of the Persian court here. But we don't know what happens to Mordechai afterwards. We do know that he becomes this venerated, honored man in the Persian court. But Chazal say that he was a member. He eventually becomes a member of the Sanhedrin. At this point, maybe yes, maybe no. Even if he was already a member of the Sanhedrin, he was in an absentia, and how much did the Abdei HaMelech know about the Sanhedrin that was all the way in Yerushalayim? It was nascent, by the way. It was only being reestablished now. So the simple answer to your question is that it's Mordechai that told him. Now, it could be because That was just a casual thing. And Mordecai said, one guy said, yeah, I'm a Protestant. One guy said, yeah, I'm a Lutheran. One guy said, yeah, I'm an Irish Catholic. And Mordecai said, yeah, I happen to be a Jew. And they all got together because they were all Persians. Or it could be that Haman was already aware of this, and the Higid Lahem is a reference to Haman. It's unspecific. It doesn't say, Ki Higid Lahem Haman, or Higid Lahem Mordecai, Asher Hu Yehudi. But either one of those, so it could be significant if it was the not simple shot and it was Haman that told them. Because we already are, in this pasuk, have the seed of Haman not liking the Jewish people. Okay, now if that's the case, and I say that because if that's the case, when we're going to ask ourselves the question in a second about what's driving Haman to do what he's doing, if we're saying that it's anti-Semitism, if it's that he hates the Jews, that's one reason to do what he's doing. If it's because he hates the king's honor being infringed upon, or even his own honor being infringed upon, the vaulting ambition, that could be another reason. Okay, it was an important horror. Okay, camera. So you say to him, Ki yid lahem asher yehudi. Vayar Haman, posuke. Ki ein Mordechai korea umishtachave lo. All right, and I have blue here for blue is vaulting ambition. All right, what does he say? If you were writing the Megillah and you wanted to say that Haman was furious about the Mordechai breaking the king's decree and he was worried about the king's honor, how would you have written this? Ki ein Mordechai
following the king.
Mekayem et dat hamelech. That's not what it says. Haman was furious. Vayar Haman, he saw ki ein Mordechai korea umishtachave lo. So it could be that was the king's order. But again, considering that we can contrast this with the other people in the Megillah, considering that fact, we're already getting into the character of Haman. Okay, Vayimaleh Haman chema. Haman is furious. Now we don't know yet whether it's vaulting ambition or the king. But what we do know, all right, and we'll see in a second. We'll see how he approaches Zachashvirish. Vayivez beinav lishloach yad Mordechai lodo. And this is where things kind of go off the rails. And we need to really ask ourselves why Haman's doing what he's doing. Okay, the people told Haman who Mordechai's people were. Now, it could be that was something that he was told 10 years ago, just passing to your point again. It could be that he was told that 10 years ago, and that's something that he knew, and that was something that he reported to the Avdei HaMelech. Or it could be that it was the Avdei HaMelech knew this, and Haman did not, and he's only now finding out now. Either way, It is clear at the very least at this point that Haman knows now that Mordechai is a Jew. Vayivez be'inav lishloach yad Mordechai levado ki yigidu lo et am Mordechai. They told him that he was a Jew, and it wasn't enough. Vayivez be'inav. It was minuscule. It was simplistic and it was ineffective. Or it's a bizayon. It would be an embarrassment for him to only go after Mordechai. Vayivakesh Haman lahashmid et kol hayudim asher b'chom achut achashverosh am Mordechai. So in response to this decree, Haman decides that it can't just be Mordechai that's got to go, it's got to be everyone. Okay, now this is, Ena Mikra Omer Ela Darsheni. Why? From what we know so far, from what we know about what Mordechai did, what the decree was, the little that we know so far about Haman's character, why is it that Haman would say, Vayivez beinav lishloach yad Mordechai levado, that it would be, that he can't just do it to Haman, it has to be to everyone?
Person.
Well, look, if it was Haman, the guy stepped on my foot off of his head, sure. All right, I agree that that's petty. If it was this guy broke a royal decree.
This is how the Jews are. This is a Jewish trait.
It's a Jewish.
And this is what we're after.
So Mordechai did something that Haman is now, and I think this is probably the simple pshat, what Abe is saying. The simple pshat is that Haman saw that what Mordechai was doing was not a function of his. Bizayon of the king. It wasn't, of his lack of respect for the monarchy. It was because it was a function of his religion. Okay. Again, this seems to be a very limited decree. Avdei HaMelech b'shar HaMelech. Avdei HaMelech b'shar HaMelech need to bow down. Now, if Mordechai, for some religious reason, for some religious affiliation, decides not to do that, what would be the logical move? Now, still not very nice, and I would argue still anti-Semitic, but what would be the logical move? Throw him out of the court. All right? So, and again, if we want to use this as a microcosm of anti-Semitism throughout Jewish history, that was the option the humane option that was used for many years. This is what happened in Russia. Russia threw everyone into the Pale settlement because this was not a people, that could ever be a part of our inner circle. So we're going to discriminate them, we're going to send them over there. Why isn't that his option? And not only that, but if we are dating Gilad Esther correctly, we even have a Pale of settlement. Over there in right? In that place that the deposed king Nebuchadnezzar, the place that he conquered, that's the way they want to go back to. Why don't we just send them there? And even the ones that don't want to go back there, let's send them there also. He doesn't do that. He immediately goes to, this can't be about just Mordechai. It has to be about the king. At the very least, I would say the first logical reaction would be to only punish Mordechai. If you're only going to punish Mordechai, he's not following court rules, throw him out of the court. If you want to say that the breach of court protocol was so bad, and this is the type of place that did this kind of thing, then kill Mordechai. But to go from here, to extend from here, to say that what Mordechai is doing is a function of his religious affiliation, and because it's a function of his religious affiliation, therefore we need to deal with the whole religion, that is extreme. That is super extreme. So, I don't think that we can resolve this, but what do you think? How do we explain this crazy, crazy leap of logic that Haman, from his perspective, that he's choosing to do? What do you think? I don't have a good answer to this.
The Jew has always been the other.
So he.
But it's always like this. Even in the later years, Hitler didn't.
Okay. So I don't mind. But you have to explain to me why. I don't mind saying that, but you have to explain to me why. Why is the fact that the Jews are different? And you're not wrong, because that's the argument that we're going to see in a second he makes to Ahasuerus. But why is it the fact that the Jews are different? All right? This is the first argument. Well, let's read on, and then we'll continue with this question. But this is the burning question of Perek Gimel, is how Haman goes from the leap of the breach of court protocol to we got to wipe out the entire religion of the people of the one guy who happens to be breaching court protocol. Pasuk Zayin. Achodesh Arishon Achodesh Nisan Meshach Shem Esrei Lamelach Achashvirah Shibur Pur Agarah Lefnei Haman. So he goes to the poor, and he decides that Adar is the month that it's going to happen. The poor could be important; it could not be important. It could be just simple Persian. Could be a simple Persian custom. Chazal understands it to be very significant in it being part of the divine, the divine hand in this. I'm interested in Haman's character. So let's assume for the moment that he's only doing this because it's what everybody in Persia is doing when they're trying to make a decision. Is they roll the dice. Fine. Now that he has his date. Okay, think about it. Think about Hashverosh, guy who rewards loyalty. And think of Haman, who we're suggesting now has a problem with his vaulting ambition. Alright, so who are they? They're Mefuzar and Mefurad. They're spread out all over the place. Alright? Their religion is different than everybody else's. Their rules are different than everybody else's. That probably does not mean religion. And the king's rules, they don't follow. And the king, it's not worth it for him to show mercy, to show tolerance for them. Okay, now this is actually...
Go ahead.
No,
it's interesting that he selects the date and he does all that stuff before he even clears with the king.
Well,
kind of
he picked the date, had the strategy. He didn't even tell the king.
He was thinking in reverse. I'm saying he
okay.
The king.
So again, I don't. The poor here is important. We name the holiday after it. The Megillah highlights its significance. I don't. I'm leaving it to the possibility that it's really just what everybody used to do. It might be more significant, but I want to focus. Unless you can tell me how you think that this is a function of either devotion to the king or vaulting ambition. I want to leave it for now.
In a way, it kind of shows that he felt the confidence to sort of semi-proceed with his plans before he...
So if Haman thinks that the stars are with him, that the mazalot are with him because of the fact that he was so important, the person with the blind vaulting ambition is the person that thinks, magiali, I do deserve for this to happen to me. Yeah!
Didn't the witches tell me already this was going to happen to me? I already know.
The text didn't tell us anything about wishes. We do have actually people...
No, I'll be back from Macbeth.
Oh, right. So, maybe. And maybe Haman had, somebody whispering in his ear, like his wife Zeresh, whom we know is predicting things for him, which we'll see in a minute. So, Haman has this idea. So, maybe you're right. Maybe that's why the poor is extremely significant. You might be right. Again, I'm going to make a point to write that down later, because I actually think it's a good heart. Okay, but here, I have the red and the green. How does Haman first present this to him? Does Haman say to Ahasuerus, listen, Ahasuerus, you know me. All right, I'm the best guy on your team. I got hit 45 home runs last year and 146 RBIs. All right, I had an on-base percentage over 400. You're not going to be able to win another World Series without me. And therefore, if somebody's messing with me, you got to realize that I'm the guy. That's not what he says. He says, Achashverosh, you're the manager of the team. Okay? This guy is questioning the authority of the manager of the ball club. If he's doing that, it's a function of the religion. I shouldn't even say that. He never says anything about Mordechai to Achashverosh. Recognize that. It's never about the petty thing. He says this is a problem that's overarching the entire place. And it's a fifth column, because they're mefuzar mefora bin amim. This thing that the Galut created, of the Jews being in little pockets all over the place, they are the ones that are, that's the problem that's going to be the end of your, right? You don't want insurrection, and these people are ripe for insurrection. We got to do something about that. All right, and again, it's couched. I put the green there. Datei HaMelech Inam Osim. Haman, who I would have to guess, knowing Achashverosh, knew that when you treat the king a certain way, he responds. He greases the wheels here. At Datei HaMelech Inam Osim. Not that they don't honor me. I'm small potatoes.
Our misfortunes. Zach Nazi said, "The Juden sind unser Unglück."
Right, and my German's a little rough, so.
Misfortune.
Right. Okay. So that's the idea. He's trying to provoke anxiety from the king. Which, when we do Achashverosh, we're gonna have to come back to this pasuk and see why Achashverosh might have been so moved by this threat of datayam inam osim. When you're dealing with a vast empire the size of the Persian Empire that Achashverosh ruled was, you know, the Jews were a pretty small minority. Why is their abandonment of the king's honor so significant? But that's a question of Achashverosh's character. But either way, Haman knew that when you talk about a threat to the king's honor, that was something that was going to mean something. Yeah.
That's the tactic of every Tzorei Yehudi. First they say the true thing, Amachad Mefuzar, we go out, it's true. And then he gives the lie.
Right.
We
don't know any Jews in this Megillah. I mean, there are some unnamed ones towards the end. I mean, in the middle towards the end about the Milchama and who the people that they were leading are. But we know a total of two Jews in this whole Megillah: Mordechai and Esther. So, we don't know anyone else. So we don't know. We have no picture at all of how populous the Jewish population was, or how big the Jewish population was in Shushan, or anywhere else. We have no idea. All we know is, he doesn't even name the Jews. All he says is, there's one people, this crazy nut, the Ku Klux Klan is out burning, you know, worshipping some other god and defying the king. We gotta deal with them. Pick your, you know, ethnicity, pick your, you know, group that people associate with. And Achashverosh reacts. Imal HaMelech Tov, Yikatzev Li'Abdom. You should write that they should be destroyed. Not only that, I'm willing to finance the whole project myself. 10,000 pieces of silver that I will put into the royal treasury just to make sure that it gets done. Okay, so we're trying to figure out what are the things that move Achashverosh. We'll discuss this next time when we're talking about Achashverosh's character. But he highlights the potential for insurrection. He offers to pay for it himself, and he offers a clean, quick fix of a royal decree demanding, you know, mandating that these people be killed. Okay, and Achashverosh's reaction is fascinating here. Fascinating. And again, we'll discuss it when we get to Achashverosh's character. The reason why I want to read it here is think about what it does to Haman. If you're a person with vaulting ambition, right, you're a person who has done a yeoman's job to suppress the vaulting ambition and make it seem like you're someone who is trying to have the king's best interest at heart, the king's honor at heart. And the king does what he's about to do, how would you react? Vayasar HaMelech HaPasukyut. Vayasar HaMelech HaTabatom Mi'al Yado. Vayitna LaHaman Ben HaMadata HaGagi Tzarer HaYudim. What is the authority of the king if not his signet ring? If not the ability to stamp his name on something and have it be a royal decree? What is royal authority if not that? And he is willingly and seemingly, wantonly, bequeathing that power to someone else. We have to get into Achashverosh about why he did that. Think about it from Haman's perspective. What does it mean for Haman? If you're somebody with vaulting ambition, and the king literally gives you the power of the king.
All powerful.
How do you think Haman felt?
Great.
Felt like $1 million, right? He felt like about not only that, but the offer of the 10,000 bucks that he offers to finance the project. Akasher says, not only that, it's yours. You don't need the money you could take from the royal treasury. You do whatever you need. We'll do whatever it is that you need to do. And again, we need to discuss why Akasher does what he does. From Haman's perspective, he gets what he wants. He gets the actual power of the king. The one person above him in power, he has the power of his decree, and he gets rich off of the job, or at least he gets to stay rich off of the job. All right, so for somebody with the vaulting ambition, this is probably going to do something to his ego. And that's why I think that this is a turning point. Because at no point in the rest of the Megillah does Haman ever seem to have the interests of the king again in heart. It seems to only be himself. And he's blinded by it. Blinded by the ambition, and then blinded by the hatred that he has because that ambition is being squelched or challenged in any way. I want to point something out just because, in case we're only going to go for 5-10 more minutes, but in case I don't get a chance to mention it, something I noticed this year that I never noticed before. Did you ever realize that in the entire Megillat Esther, Haman and Mordechai never say a word to each other? There's no indication.
Even when he's taking him on.
There's no indication that until that moment, Mordechai or Haman ever noticed each other publicly. There's never an indication that Mordechai ever even notices Haman, other than the fact that he defies the royal decree. But it's all, originally, it's couched in the royal decree. He knows that Haman is the guy that puts up the Pashkavils in the shul, saying that all the Jews need to die. He's the guy with the, you know, but it's the king's signature. It is fascinating to me. I don't think it can be emphasized enough. It is fascinating that despite this, you know, clash of, right? This is like Superman and Lex Luthor over here, right? These arch enemies that we always perceive them to be, they never say a word to each other. And let's think about that, and maybe we'll come back to it if we do Mordechai's character. Because I think that that can't be insignificant. Okay. All right, and then the rest of the parak is the enactment of the announcement of the decree. Okay, let's very quickly, that was the introduction of Haman. I'll just emphasize one more time. In that, we have the introduction of what gets somebody places with the king, which is loyalty, having the king's best interest at heart. We have Haman and what seems to be at least the seeds of his vaulting ambition. And we have the king's reaction to Mordechai and how he puts that on all the Jewish people. Again, that's a point that we really need to think about some more. But then we have Achashverosh's reaction to this type of character and what it might be doing, what it possibly is doing to somebody with that vaulting ambition. Alright? Okay, if you're a pure servant who lives only to serve, okay, if you're Samwise Gamgee, okay, I'm sorry I keep using that term, but if you're there only to serve, then being given the power of the king is not something that matters to you. You're given that power because it's what you need to do in order to fulfill your duty. Who was it James Madison in Federalist 10 said in the Federalist Papers, he said that if men were angels, we wouldn't need government, right? But he also said that if I forget the exact line, the idea is that if human beings weren't inherently corruptible, which every human being is, then putting all the power in one person wouldn't be a problem, because he would never have his or her own interests at heart. It would always just be the people's. Putting too much power in a leader, the inherent problem with that, which is what the founders thought, which is one of the really interesting and special chidushim of the founding of the country, was that you can't put all too much power in one person. Haman is somebody who is perfectly susceptible for believing that he was more special than he actually was, and he was given that power. And it immediately seems to be corrupting him. Okay, let's take a look at source number 4. Haman's blindness. All right, that's what I titled this parshia, this section. Right, I skipped the entire first part. Right, Perek Dalet is Haman and Esther plotting. Right, it's Hatach running between Haman and Esther, figuring out, discovering the plot. Mordechai and Esther. Hatach going between Mordechai and Esther, discovering the plot, planning. Esther going and beseeching in front of Ahasuerus. The beginning of Perek Hay is Esther doing that. And now, what happens? How does it end? Esther goes in. Ahasuerus lifts his shavita zahav, and what does Esther request of him?
Come to my
big shebang. But my big shebang is not only for you, but it's going to be for you and Haman. Okay, why Ahasuerus reacts the way he does is for the Ahasuerus here. But Haman's reaction is where we're picking up with over here. To that, to being invited to a royal party for him and a royal dinner for him and the king hosted by Esther. Think of the vaulting ambition. Think of the guy who was just given the power of the king. How do you think somebody's going to react? If you have the vaulting ambition, you're just given the power of the king, and now the queen herself is inviting you. How do you think you're going to react? It's feeding the vaulting ambition. You feel like $1 million. And he actually says that. Sameach v'tov lev. Right, that's a phrase used around Tanakh. I mean, real simple. V'chirot haman et Mordechai b'shar ha-melech. And then he sees Mordechai at the shar ha-melech. V'lo kam v'lo zam imenu. He doesn't get up. Now this is probably a tangential point, but I think extremely significant. What was the original royal decree? Who needed to bow when? Avdei HaMelech only in the court. Is Mordechai in the court now? Where is he?
Shalom.
The Shar. He's in the outside gate. Why is he? He's not entering because he's still in Avel B'Chafui Rosh. He's wearing sackcloth. Mordechai is there. This isn't even the place where the decree is relevant. Nobody's supposed to be bowing to him here. And yet, it's Mordechai not following a decree that he has no business following at this point anyway. And Haman, who thinks that he is now the cat's pajamas, Haman who thinks that he is the guy who used to be that he was just one peg below the king, now he seems to be equal to the king. He's got all the king's power. He's got an invitation seemingly on equal footing with the king from the queen. And yet, it's not even the violation of the decree anymore that bothers him. If we had any doubt as to whether Haman was being driven by the king's honor or his own, here it's not the king's honor, and it is purely his own. And it's his own honor being infringed upon at a time and place where it wasn't even necessary. And this person with the vaulting ambition reacts. V'chirot Haman et Mordechai b'shar ha-melech v'lo kam v'lo zam imenu v'yimaleh Haman al Mordechai chema. I titled this Haman's Blindness, because everything that I just said, Haman seems to be completely blind to. The text seems to, I mean, we gloss over it, usually, but it seems to indicate that Haman didn't even notice that the decree didn't apply here in the Shar HaMelech. Okay. Vayitapach Haman. Right? But, and this is maybe the last moment of strength and self-control that Haman actually displays. Vayitapach Haman. He displays self-control. Vayavo al beito vayishlach vayavayadu vayadarazirazirazirishto. He doesn't do anything. He has the royal symbol, the royal signet ring. He could have set off with his head right there, but he realizes that's petty and small and silly, and he stays his hand. And then he goes home, and now we have the rabble rouser at home that causes his trouble. He tells them all about all of the great things that happened to me today. I'm the man. I got royal decrees. I got royal power. I'm pretty much on equal footing with the king. I am. All of my ambition is finally paid off. But on top of all this, I'm going to the party. But the chose pasuk yud gimel einenu shoveli the cholait asher ani roed Mordechai yodi yoshev b'shar ha-melech. What's now? What does it point? What does it say? Every time he sees Mordechai, does it say every time he sees Mordechai, Shalo yichrav lo yishtachaveh? No. Every time, b'chol asher ani ro'eh et Mordechai ha-Yehudi, yoshev b'shar ha-melech. He's come to associate. And this is, all right, if you want to talk about somebody who's got the tunnel vision of a psychological disorder, right? Somebody who's got their eyes on one thing and can't see the panoply of factors that go into any one situation. This is Haman right now. He looks at this and he says, I don't even care about the bowing anymore. Mordechai, that jerk Mordechai, drives me crazy. And I can't get past it. All I need to do is deal with this Mordechai guy, and then everything will be fine. And what would be the logical response to this? If you were Haman's wife, and he came home from a long day and he said, honey, I got the power of the world at my fingertips, but none of it matters to me because there's this jerk Mordechai who really annoys me. What would be the logical response?
Kill him.
I mean, kill him? Why is kill him not a necessary step? Well, no, but even, I think ignore him probably makes most sense. But why is kill him not necessary?
Yeah, so much.
But who is Mordechai? What is Mordechai?
Nobody.
Well, he's maybe, whether he's a nobody or not, what tribal affiliation does he have? He's a Jew. What do we know about the Jews so far in this story? At this point in the story, what's going to happen to the Jews? They're all dying. Ignore it because you have the power of the world at your fingertips. Why would you let this silly man bring you down? But more than that, you want this guy gone? He's going to be gone. You just need to wait. Why can't you wait? Wait just until Adar. Just until the 13th of Adar and everything's going to be just fine. It's a few more days. Why are you so upset? Did you hear what you just told me, Haman? Sweetie, honey, alright? You just told me everything about how you are on top of the world. You are on equal footing with the most powerful man in the world. And Zeresh whispers in his ear. Now, Zeresh is another character profile that we don't have much on her, but we could develop about what motivates her for saying this. I don't care about that. What I don't care about is think about the state that Haman must have been in to say to himself after he gets this advice. What's the advice that he gives her? We'll read it inside very quickly. Zeresh says back to him, Atomer lo Zeresh yishto b'cholo avav. They say back to him. This is not Haman's idea. This is their idea. Yasu eitz gavoa chamishim ama. Make a 50-foot tree. Vaborku yamor al melech v'yitlu et mordechai alav uvo yim amelech al amishteh sameach. Vayitava demar al lefnei ama. Okay. And so Zeresh comes along and gives him this idea of a 50-foot tree. Now, I don't care, I mean, I care about why Zeresh is saying what she's saying. I think it's a really important question for her character. But for Haman's character, what's so significant about this? She gives him this nut job idea of making a 50-foot tree, right, on the day that he's supposed to be going to the queen, the royal banquet, where he himself alone was invited, and the response was, great idea. All right? The logical, calculated, normal person who cares about their position is going to not bother the king with trivial silliness about some guy sitting at the Shar HaMelech who's wearing soiled clothing, all right, when he's being invited to the royal banquet. And yet, I would argue, it's the vaulting ambition, the blindness, that I think is first mostly extremely evident in this chapter that we see. Okay, we're going to, 2 more minutes, we're going to finish up. Okay, source number 5 is Haman's blindness leads to his downfall. Why? Because now he has this idea in his head, actually thinking, he had a tunnel vision, inability to see any of the other factors at play, any of the other innocent could see the complete insanity of what he's about to do. He goes to Ahasuerus in the middle of the night, boss, I got a great idea. Let's put all of our money and investments into rubber bands. Right? It's a great idea. We're going to make millions. You're a nut job. What are you doing? Right? Boss, I got a great idea. There's this guy sitting. He looks like a beggar. He's wearing the clothing. I think he used to be in the court, but he fell on hard times. And now, that doesn't matter who he is. But the whole world will be so much better if you just let me hang him. This is the most powerful man in the world, who's essentially being asked right now by his chief advisor, all right, being asked by his chief advisor to go find somebody that looks like a homeless beggar on the street and to hang him. As if that's something that he seems to need Ahasuerus' permission for in the first place. Blind, absolutely blind. And he comes and, of course, we know the story, Ayomar Haman Balibo, Amiach Potz HaMelech La'asot Yekarim V'Terim Meni. Ahasuerus asks him, what do I do to somebody who I want to honor? And Haman reacts. And again, think of the vaulting ambition. Somebody who's blind to everything else. Do you honestly think, all right, if you're Haman, do you honestly think that the king would be asking you advice for how to honor somebody, and that person is you? Who does that? All right, if you want to do something really nice for your spouse, right, you want to throw a surprise party, do you go over to the spouse and say, sweetie, if somebody really wants to surprise somebody well with a really nice party, what do you think they would do? It's crazy. And yet, when he's so blinded, that's his first thought. So we've come a long way from the calculating Haman, who knows what to do and how to, you know, put the right foot forward in order to get ahead from that we were introduced to in Perek Gimel. Now we have somebody who's so blind with his ambition, his devolving ambition is so turneth over and over again, overleaps itself and falls on the other to such a degree that he's actually doing this crazy idea. And Ahasuerus, again, we got to get back to Ahasuerus' character. He realizes, and I think that he's realizing already from previously. Ahasuerus is realizing this nut Haman, who I thought had really had the stuff for greatness, he really is just only after himself. He's really only interested in his own career. And that's why Ahasuerus knows what he's doing, and he sets this up for Haman, and then he says, yeah, Mordechai, go. So, well, let's skip through all of this. Again, our blue is our devotion to the king. The king, and I'll just make this point. If we are trying to contrast these two modes of service, actual commitment to the king on the one hand and vaulting ambition on the other, Haman originally, in the beginning of his career, knows that option A is the way that you, not only the way that you get ahead, but the way that you are, the way that Ahasuerus is going to like you in this, the way that success is spelled with option A, devotion to the king, loyalty. And then you have option B, vaulting ambition. For somebody who's now guided by option B to have to do this, this is the beginning, and I would say essentially the end of his downfall. Let's go skip to the bottom of source 5. He comes back at the end of this whole story. What did they see immediately? All right, this is Haman, I'm sorry, but you're going down. You thought that you were going to destroy the Jewish people. This guy Mordechai is a Jew. Now, whether they mean that they've consulted with the necromancers and they know the future, or whether they mean that this is Ahasuerus is never going to allow the Jewish people to be destroyed at this point, because he loves Haman, he loves Mordechai, and he clearly does not love you, right? If he's making you do this, considering this factor, I'm sorry, Haman, but the death knell has been rung. Okay, let's very quickly. Source number 6. Now, that point of him telling Zeresh and his members of his household about what happened with him going to Ahasuerus, that's the last time we hear Haman say anything. All of the seventh chapter is Haman passive, right? We see that Haman's vayivakesh, he begs the king for mercy, but we don't actually hear any more dialogue from him. So he comes with Esther to the party. Esther sets this up. Again, this is about Esther and Ahasuerus' character, and it's about the larger story. Very important. But I'll just very quickly run through Pasuk Hey. Vayomer HaMelech Ahasuerus, Esther tells him who it is. This is Esther playing on Mordechai's character, which is why we need to know who Esther is, we need to know who Mordechai is to see why this is working. But Ahasuerus reacts, Mi Uzev Yezehu Asher Lo Olim Olasos Kain. Who's doing this? Vayomer Esther, Ish Tsar Ve'Oyev, Haman, Hara Zeh, this evil man, V'Haman Yivas Mifnei HaMelech Ve'Amalka. He's dumbfounded. He's shocked. Now, V'Haman Yivas Mifnei HaMelech Ve'Amalka. Why? Why is he so shocked?
He didn't know Esther was Jewish.
That's simple reason. Simple shot number one. Give me, based on our vaulting ambition thesis here, our theory. Why? If somebody is, can you imagine, the Medrash says that he had a bucket of stuff on his head when he came back from this day with Mordechai, right? Somebody who experienced the debasing, walking through the, God, he turned from the second command, most powerful man in the world, equal to the most powerful man in the world, to somebody who was basically a stable boy. And still so blinded by his vaulting ambition that he still thinks that nothing's happening. Even having been told by his wife and his advisors, you're going down, Haman, still thinks everything's okay. And then, the Haman Nivas Mufnei HaMelech Ve'Amalka, dumbfounded, shocked, he has no idea. I thought I was the most important man. I'm here, aren't I? He doesn't see it. He doesn't see the rug being pulled over his head. He doesn't see the fact that he's being conspired against at this point in the story. Haman is the classic case of somebody who starts off and then is so blinded by his ambition, so blinded by the hubris of his own advancement, all right, of his own idea, that he doesn't, at this point, he's blind to everything. And proof of, one last proof of this, what happens? Ahasuerus leaves the room, not sure what to do. V'aman amad, he stands there, he's begging for it, literally. Now the guy knows that his life is essentially over. Because now he's back to the point of realizing that I've wronged the king, I've crossed the king. Then Ahasuerus comes back, and what happens? V'aman nofel al amita asher ester alav. Okay, so how do we always read this pasuk? That Haman fell, nofel al amita asher ester alav. That he actually, I always pictured it, that Esther was trying to set this up, of Ahasuerus going nuts. So she had one of her servants, put out, Haman fell over, and she knew she had, it was good timing. She knew how to tick off Achashverosh the right way. Another way to read this, possibly, and I'll close with this. Another possible way to read this is Haman nofel, not unintentionally, but intentionally. He was kneeling on Esther's bed. Esther is sitting on her bed, and he, picture Esther sitting on her couch, and he's sitting there holding her hand, saying, "Please, please, beautiful queen, help me, help me," sitting right next to her. Again, not unintentionally, but intentionally, begging for her mercy, but while sitting next to her. Again, somebody so blinded by their ambition, thinking that it would be appropriate for them to sit next to the queen on her own couch, on her own bed, to beg at this point. This is somebody that should be groveling on the floor, rolling around in the dirt, rolling around in the mud, trying to show the king, "I'm nothing, I'm nothing. Ich bin agurnisht, ich bin agurnisht." All right? But he doesn't. Even in his last act, if we at least can say that that's a plausible read of the pasuk, even in his last act, he still can't rid himself of this ambition that ends his, that essentially spells his downfall and ultimately ends his entire career and, we know, ends the life of him, and not only him, but his lineage as well. Yishkoach, everybody, thank you so much. I hope this gave us at least a little bit of an insight into Haman's character, and I hope it opens up our, at least opens up our eyes a little bit more reading Megillat Esther here. Yishkoach, everybody. Have a good day.